Yeah, how are you?
Good.
Can we talk about this?
Start with the.
Well, I know, but some of these endorsements are only for 2 years.
Okay, we're going to call this meeting to order. This is the Transportation and Public Safety Committee meeting of Wednesday, March 26th, 2014. Still waiting for one more member so that we will have quorum, but we'll go ahead and get started with Senator Bach's bill presentation on Senate File 2593. Welcome, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. We have a delete all that we have to wait for a quorum for, I guess, but we take a testimony to that.
Great. Is that in our? Oh, here it is.
The situation, Mr. Chairman of committee members, is in the city of Two Harbors on the north shore of Lake Superior along Highway 61. The city would like to put some wayfinding signs inside the city that direct some of the traffic to their downtown business district down on Main Street and the shore of Lake Superior, but the current law doesn't give MnDOT the authority to be able to use wayfinding signs inside the city limits. I believe somebody in council could correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they can do that outside of the city limits, but not inside the city limits, I believe, is what I was told. So the bill originally drafted was much broader, a statewide policy. The delete all amendment is going to create a pilot program specific to the city limits of the city of Two Harbors. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I have representatives from the city here that would like to speak to the bill.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Robin Glazer. I'm on the City Council, and I'm also a member of the Two Harbors Planning Commission. City of Two Harbors has been working on this project for greater than 4 years now, trying to find a way to bring citizens, tourists, particularly to the downtown and the waterfront area of Two Harbors. Highway 61, as you know, connects Two Harbors. Duluth is at the south, and we're kind of the gateway to the North Shore. There's so much more to Two Harbors than what people see as they're driving in and on 7th Avenue. I'm sure some of you have been there on a holiday weekend when traffic is backed up quite significantly. We are looking for a way, and legislation will improve travel along this corridor, helping people find their way to the downtown, where they can actually, we actually have a business district. We also have museums and a working harbor where you can actually watch ore boats being loaded, which we think is important for the tourists that might not realize that there's so much more to Two Harbors. We've been working with MnDOT, professional planners, and professional engineers to develop the sign program. Proposing the wayfinding signs uses proven concepts from other communities across the country. We recently completed a visual concept, and believe that this project would not only be an improvement to our community, but if this works in Two Harbors, it would also be an asset to other communities within the state of Minnesota. We thank you for listening to us and for authoring this bill.
Great. Thank you, Councilmember Glazer. A quorum is present. Why don't we go ahead and put the amendment before us? Members, we have an author's amendment, the A1, the effect of which causes this to be a pilot project in the city of Two Harbors. Senator Reiner moves the A1. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the pilot program would, Josh Bergstead, city planner for Two Harbors, what the pilot program would do is allow the city to install several sign installations inside the right-of-way of Trunk Highway 61. Currently, there is a community destination sign program that MnDOT has, but it's more limited than what we believe is needed and also would be effective. This program would expand the use to allow private business destinations within the city limits, which, as noted earlier, many types of retail and service businesses are allowed to have signs, official program signs outside of city limits. They would be the blue signs or the, you know, the logo franchise signs you see on the interstate. And this program would also expand the number of destinations on a sign panel installation from 3 or 4 to 5 destinations. And those are really the only changes that we're looking to. What some of the concerns we've been confronted in the past are proliferation of signs and clutter. Because this would be a program administered by the city, you know, with MnDOT's cooperation, you know, there would only be one installation basically per block. We would still meet the spacing standards between signs and the intersections, and we would be able to control then what types of messages go on these signs.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Burkhead. Questions, members? So, Senator Buck, I see that Ms. Groth from MnDOT is on the testifiers list. Ms. Groth, were you wanting to provide testimony? Or okay, great. All right, Senator Buck, did you have something?
Well, yeah. Mr. Chairman, there's an A2 amendment that I'd like to have the committee have a conversation about, and I'm not sure how the department actually feels. But members, the A2 amendment on line 1.23, and on 1.23, what the A2 amendment will do is, after the word services, insert specified by business name. And that is not the recommended language that MnDOT worked with us on the A1 amendment. It was when the city looked at the amended version with the pilot program, they actually requested that they be able to use the business name on those signs, and the A1 amendment they felt didn't provide. So I'm not sure how the department feels about that. It's probably not critically important, but I think if we could, probably, if, for instance, if Betty's Pies was down at the waterfront in Two Harbors, and they're not, but mm-hmm. if they were, I think people driving by would like to know that specifically, be a well-branded name. So just for the committee's consideration, that, like I said, I'm not sure what the department feels with. So maybe we could get there.
Right. Senator Bach, I'm looking at this drawing. So it would make something like this with, for example, Castle Danger Brewery possible on a sign like this.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, to be a little more specific about what is done. Okay. And, you know, some businesses get branded. Svenanoli's Pizza and Grand Marais, certainly a brand name. It might be more helpful to travelers on Highway 61 to have that on the sign versus pizza.
Right. Well, so... Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me we see those all over, Arby's and McDonald's and all. I mean, there's all those exits when you go down Highway 35. Aren't we talking about just about the same thing?
Mr. Chairman, I think what you see are probably signs outside of city limits. What we're talking about is inside the city limits. The rules are different on highways outside of city limits versus inside of city limits, apparently.
Well, that's wrong.
So speech in favor.
Yeah.
All right, Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, or I would just be curious in how you're going to decide what business goes on the sign. You going to let them bid for that? Or?
No, we Mr. Burks, we sir. Have passed. I'm sorry. Josh Burks again. We have passed a city ordinance establishing a sign program that would have an annual permitting type or annual sign panel designation where, based on a first-come, first-serve submission, those businesses along that route would have the chance to have a sign panel. We realize that some businesses that may want panels would not be able to get them under this, but you know, we're prepared to work with that. And then we would also have, off of Highway 61, within our city streets, we would have more wayfinding signs, so to give other businesses along that route some directional assistance as well.
Yeah. Madam Chair, do we have to move the A2 amendment?
Yeah.
Oh, you already did.
Senator Reiner?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A2, we can get it out there, and then we can take some testimony from MnDOT and others on it. But I'm supportive of the A2, so I'll move the A2 amendment.
Senator Reinert moves the A2 amendment. Discussion?
Madam Chair, I think if the department would like to testify, I'd like to.
Ms. Grubb?
I honestly don't know how they feel. So, sound well. We're not trying to create problems for the department. We're just trying to help the businesses that are off of Highway 61 without creating too much of a stir.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Sue Groth, and I am the state traffic engineer for the Minnesota DOT. And I would like to thank the members that we've worked with from Two Harbors on this bill. It's come, you know, quite a ways from where we started, so I really appreciate the efforts to get it more into what is something that would be more acceptable to MnDOT. However, there are some things that we do want to just make the committee aware of that's very important for them to understand. And if you would bear with me just a little bit, I want to back up and just talk about traffic signs a little bit and why they're important and kind of how we prioritize them along the highway, and then we can get into some specific questions. I did bring the state signing engineer with me. If we have questions I can't answer, I may ask her to come up and also testify. But just in general, there are... Every sign that is on the highway is considered a traffic control device. So even when you see a sign that that has a logo on it that's advertising McDonald's, that has been deemed to be a motorist information sign, and they're all governed by the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, which you may have all heard of, which is brought or given to us that we adopt through federal regulations. And of course, there's three broad categories of signs. You've got your regulation, your warning, and your guide signs. And these signs fall into our something called supplementary guide signs. So I'd like to hand this out so we can have a little bit of a better conversation about the issue. So. Of course, priority for signs first goes to our stop signs and our warning signs and curb signs, those things, and then our primary guide signs, and then last of all would be these supplemental guide signs. And the handout that I've given you today kind of talks more about what supplemental guide signs are, and if you flip over to page 2 on that page, it kind of shows, it gets into our different signing programs that we have. And the one thing with all these signing programs that's really important for everybody to remember is that they all have different criteria for what's allowed and what's not allowed, and all of those criteria are brought down to us through these federal regulations. And one thing that's very that the feds are very concerned about is the difference between advertising versus motorist service. And so advertising, you cross over into advertising when at least in my opinion, when you are talking about something that an unfamiliar driver would not normally be looking for. For example, in the bill, you know, specifically they talk about personal services, which I consider things like a hair salon, a repair shop. Maybe you'd be looking for that if your car broke down, but a hardware store. Those are not normal things that people would be looking for. Things such as a waterfront would be a tourist attraction. That's where the feds kind of divide between something that's providing a motorist service versus something that's more advertising. And so that's where we run into a little bit of problem with the actual language in the bill and this amendment that now is specifically asking that we put business names on these signs. If we were to sign for a hardware store in the city of Two Harbors, that would be the first time that we would have signed for a hardware store within the right-of-way of a state highway. And so that is where the real crux of the issue is with this bill. It's the types of services that are allowed on the sign and the fact that we'd be crossing over into what the feds would consider advertising versus motorist service. So unfortunately, with that comes some consequences. And we adopt the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and it has to be in substantial conformance with the federal guidelines. And so we have adopted that. We have our own manual. And if we establish a program that does not comply with that, we do open ourselves up to potential repercussions from the feds. And I'm not saying that this would happen, but it is just a potential. They could withhold funding from us ultimately if we weren't in compliance with their manual. And so that's where I think if we could work on eliminating the businesses that would truly never, you know, would truly not be considered motorist service from the eligibility, I think then we could come to some sort of a better agreement. The other things as far as the number of businesses, the size of the signs, those types of engineering things, I think we can work through, but it's really the types of services and the fact that we would be essentially advertising on a community wayfinding sign. And there is a letter from the Federal Highway Administration that I've attached on page 4 and 5, and they looked at the original bill and there was some question when we heard this bill in the House whether we would really be in violation of federal regulations. And this on page 5, the final sentence there does show that, or does state that it's the opinion of the division administrator from FHWA here in town that we would be non-compliant with, would be non-compliant and by reference to the Code of Federal Regulations. So that's where I think we just need to use some caution. And again, if we could have some criteria around the types of services that make them more like types of services that would be important to travelers versus opening it up to any general retail. And that's exactly what it says in this bill on 1.7. It's saying sell goods and services at retails or directly to an end user consumer, whereas we would want it to be to an unfamiliar driver or a tourist or a motorist. So just needed to make you aware of that. But like I said, thanks, because I think we have come quite a ways from where we originally started. So.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, for the committee members that aren't familiar with Highway 61, it looks like a city street. It's 7th Avenue, highway next down into a two-lane city street with stoplights on it going through. You would probably think it's the main street of Two Harbors had you not known that the real downtown business district is actually closer to the waterfront. But just want to make the committee aware of what the highway really looks like as it goes through the city.
Senator Ryan.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, I mean, we really seem to be having a conversation about the underlying concept, so maybe we could take a vote on the A2 amendment and then continue on with the A1 as amended.
All right. Any other discussion on the A2 amendment?
Question, Madam Chair.
Senator Champion.
Senator Bach, what are your thoughts about this A2 amendment now that we have had a representative from MnDOT come forward and say if this amendment is adopted and if we operate in compliance with the amendment that we will then be non-compliant with the Federal Highway Administration and therefore could impact our relationship?
Madam Chair, Senator Campion, I guess I would, one, I would say this is a pilot program. I expect the city is going to work with MnDOT to be as compliant as we possibly can. I know the city officials there, and I expect they will be sensitive to that. And I also have to believe that it would give us an opportunity to make some, the federal changes. They would send us some kind of a letter telling us that we're in violation and some recommendations of what we might need to change before they just didn't send a check. So I think we, in the event the pilot program didn't meet the requirements, actually some opportunity, some communications to get into requirements. And that's certainly how I would view the legislation and how I would expect the pilot program.
Senator Bach and Ms. Groth, I suppose, I was wondering if in the A2 amendment, if there might not be an opportunity to clarify that the types of businesses might need to be relevant for travel purposes. I, I am very familiar with this stretch of 61, having driven it many times, so I know exactly what you're talking about. And frankly, it took us a while to find the waterfront, so I understand the challenge. And we've talked in this committee in different contexts about that there is a public safety value in people knowing that what you're looking for is over there rather than wandering around cluelessly on the, you know, on the highway, not being able to find whichever destination. And if it happens to be a retail name, as we've seen in some of the other signage. So that's why I was wondering if there might be some clarifying language that might make everybody comfortable. Ms. Groth?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to work more on that language. I think it's lines 1.8 through 1.13 that those, I mean, the fact that those are specifically called out, that doesn't leave us a lot of room. Those, if we could modify those, I think that would be very helpful.
And just to be clear, at this point, we're talking about the A2 amendment, which after line point on 1.23 would add specified by business name. So I see your point on the other part, but let's get this one out of the way first, and then we'll come back to that. Senator Ryan, No reactions at this point on that part?
No reactions, okay. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Bach.
Some of the department's concerns. I'm not sure that the fact that it's a pilot program, we have to work together and essentially sign off on what it's going to look like. We have to believe that we can figure out a city and MnDOT.
Okay. All right.
What MnDOT needs as possible.
Senator Sanjip.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would just say that to me, it's totally illogical that you can have Redberry Winery or McDonald's or anything on the outside of town, but you can't specify by business name a business name within a town. I'd like to talk to the Federal Highway people about that logic because I can't get there. And the other one is, I think communities like this, whether it's Grandma's in Duluth or whatever, they do have businesses that have established a brand and are generally kind of known around the state of Minnesota, and we all read about them at some point in time. But when we get to Two Harbors, we might want to find them, and this would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right. Additional comments, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wondering if the engineer, signage engineer, has any input on what this would mean for outside of Two Harbors. I also understand the limitations in Two Harbors. I drive there at least once a month up on the way to Finland, Minnesota for our cabin. And frankly, it was until recently that I finally found the waterfront business district. So I completely agree that you need more help in terms of getting people who are not familiar with that to the right place. But wondering the bigger implications, because this sounds like the first exception that we would have in our state. Or am I wrong with that assumption?
Madam Chair and Senator, I think because this is a pilot program, it really would, that's one of the reasons why we proposed it being a pilot program, and specifically because the original bill was for a statewide program, and so I think that was one of the great things that we did. It says, let's just talk about this in Two Harbors. So I think really right now the issue is the types of businesses that would be allowed, and I believe the direction that we've been moving is that restaurants would be allowed and their names could be used. But again, it would be a restaurant that a tourist would be looking for versus a hardware store or a lumber shop. I mean, that's where it's opening it up to any general retail. But the way some of the other programs work, things like motels, recreational camping, restaurants, those types of, again, things that motorists would be looking for versus any general retail. That's where the difference is, where you get this fine line between advertising and providing a motorist service. So that's the direction I would like to move and with the program.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Groth. All right. So
one follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So and
on
then
the A2 amendment, just making
on
sure.
The,
yeah.
And we're on the A2 amendment.
Well, it's related to the A2 because my question is, as it works with the A1, is it one sign that we're having in this pilot program? And I might have missed that earlier. Or is that still to be determined? Because if it's one sign and you can only have so many on the sign in a pilot program, it doesn't seem to be that, you know, that much of a burden to figure out whether it actually works.
Madam Chair,
yes,
and Senator, it's multiple signs. It's a program of signs
throughout the city.
Yeah, I think between 4 to 6 or 8, I think, is what's been talked about.
Thank you.
And Senator, Madam Chair, is that specified in the language? Might be missing it. The 6 to 5 program, or?
Madam Chair and Senator, I know that the numbers are not, but there is quite a bit of limitation for space and those types of things that have already been looked at. So I think that the actual locations of the signs have been selected. And so from there, then it's the number of businesses per sign. And then the real issue that we've been having most difficulty over is what businesses would qualify for those signs.
Thank you.
All right. On the A2 motion from Senator Reinert, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Now
Madam
back
Chair.
To the A1. Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just now to the A1. Obviously, I'm, first of all, to Senator Franz and to Senator Kent, if you're coming through my town, which you are, to get to Two Harbors, I want to know about it next time. So we appreciate both Senator Bach and I appreciate you coming up our way. Senator Bach is famous for talking about his district being the place everyone goes to play, and I'd make that argument for Duluth as well. But
we
very familiar with our,
on our way.
Thank you. Next time, call. Very familiar with our friends in Two Harbors. They've got a great mayor, Randy Boland, who I know has been working on this issue for a number of years. I can remember when I was in the House, him calling me up on this. And there's a real issue, and I think most of us have something similar in our districts. I mean, you could take I-35 going through Duluth, and, I mean, it's completely within the city limits, and you know, I like the idea that we have a pilot program here in one place where we can sort of try it out and figure it out. Members, you know, I just draw your attention to Subdivision 4. The city's going to pay all the costs of it. So, you know, I think Senator Tomasoni summed it up from the get-go. Like, it's crazy that as soon as you get outside city limits, you can advertise these various things and know that if I want to get off in Hinckley at, you know, A, B, or C, that it's there. But when you're inside a community with a stretch, you don't know. And people that drive through Two Harbors and don't ever take a right-hand turn are missing the best part of Two Harbors. So whatever we can do to move us in that direction, I think, is helpful. Make sure Randy Boland knows I said that. Thank you.
I will. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bach, I see in the A1 amendment there in subsection 4 and 1.3, zero relating to program costs. It's the intent of your bill for the city to pay for the costs of the sign. Is that accurate?
Correct.
So then, Madam Chair and Senator Bach, I see we got a fiscal note from MnDOT here that starting next year it's basically $37,000 and then continues on at that level. And looking at that, it says they need that it's going to cost them that amount basically to establish the program requirements and then to review it on an annual basis. And it sounds like your intent of the bill was that it wouldn't cost the department any dollars. I mean, are you willing to, or is this, or maybe the question is for the city of Two Harbors, are you willing to let the department invoice you for those costs moving forward in order to do the program so it truly is a no-cost program? Or,
Madam Chair, maybe Council can tell us why this comes at a cost, but I've been around here long enough to know the departments like to get paid for everything. Huge sums of money to run their departments. They like to be able to come back and get paid for things that we tell them they have to do. And I don't know anything about MnDOT's budget. I've never served on transportation, but they can't figure out how to do this. Work with the city to develop this pilot program without it costing additional money is a mystery to me. And Glenn Hill, the district engineer up in Duluth, I have an excellent relationship with. believe he's going to hire extra people to do this. He's got great people working in that office. Someone will put something else on their time card, I guess, to be able to justify the additional money that they've secured from the legislature. But I don't understand why it costs money.
Yeah.
I don't think it should cost money, but maybe council can tell us why it's scored this.
Ms. Boyd.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach and committee, this fiscal note is written to the as-introduced version of the bill. The amendment would take away some cost, presumably because putting the program cost of the signs onto the city. But the fiscal note does specify staff time. Now, this is very likely an opportunity cost rather than new staff. And the fiscal note would need to be updated on the engrossment, but there will still be a fiscal note. I would invite the department to comment further on what those costs might be. But in terms of the committee's work, the bill would still need to go to finance, even if just for an opportunity cost of the department.
Madam Chair, maybe we can find out in finance that fiscal note is now that it's just a pilot program rather than a statewide policy.
Will do. Thank you, Senator. Additional questions or comments, members? All right. Okay. Sorry, we're regrouping on our amendments here. All right. Would anyone like to make a motion? Senator Reiner.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we have the A1 amendment before us. So,
yes. Yes.
If we put that on, I'll move to send the bill forward.
We did. It was a delete.
We did that already.
It was a delete all authors. So that one was adopted. So.
I missed that. Thank you.
So then. Now we need a motion for Senator Reiner.
I'll move the bill. Usually you fill in the blanks. Madam Chair, I will move Senate file 2593 as amended. And is it being held over? Oh, and move to with recommendation of this committee and send it to the Finance Committee.
All right. On Senator Reiner's, Senator Weir.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I was wondering if the author would prefer an effective date upon enactment. If it doesn't, if you had that option, would you want that?
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Senator Weger, the city tells me that August 1st effective date is fine. I've been trying to get this for years. I think a couple more months to get ready, probably not damaging to them. Never gotten this far. Thank you, Senator Weger, for being sensitive. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Berezovsky wants to comment on this.
Madam Chair, should I withdraw my motion? I've got a pending motion. So
thank you, Senator
Reiner. I will withdraw my motion.
Thank you. Ms. Berezovsky.
Madam Chair and Senators, the effective date in the A1 amendment is it encompasses local approval of the City of Two Harbors, which is required because it's special legislation naming the City of Two Harbors and requiring it to pay the costs of a program. So under the Minnesota Constitution and the legislation enacted under it, the city has to approve it formally before it's bound by this legislation. So that's typically expressed in the effective date, and that's why the effective date reads as it does.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good clarification. That makes perfect.
Any other questions? Okay, Senator Reiner renews his motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. All right, Senator Bach, thank you for your patience. We are going to move on to Senate File 2663. And we are having some duplicating issues, so we will have some new copies out shortly.
Thank you.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, there's an engrossed version of Senate Bill 2663. It came out of the Environment Committee. Members, this is a bill that was brought to me by a constituent who is 100% disabled. And under the law, individuals who are 100% disabled can receive free hunting and fishing licenses. Receive a card from the Department of Natural Resources, but then there are a number of other kinds of licenses that they don't get a permanent card for. In order them to get the free license that they're eligible for, they have to go to the doctor and get slips that show that they are personally permanently disabled, bring them to the license issuing place to prove that, and then receive the license. So I've been working with DNR on this. On behalf of this constituent who thinks that it's just ridiculous, they're 100% permanently disabled, that's not going to change, and they are wondering why they just can't have that on their driver's license so they don't have to repeatedly go to the doctor and get the disability papers to bring to the license issue. So, the request of the bill is that you place on the back of the driver's license, like other endorsements that it has, that the individual is 100% permanently disabled. And then that would then work for the license issuers for DNR type licenses. When they went to the registrar to purchase the licenses, the driver's license would indicate their disability. So that's the reason we're here. I don't think there's a department about this. Might be the right policy, but there's a cost of updating the data, and that only happens periodically. So the effective date of this is actually pushed out a couple of years to coincide with when public safety plans to go out and update their software. So, and the cost is being carried at the Game and Fish Fund, same thing. For some reason, this costs $100,000 to reprogram in order to put the words in the back of your driver's license that you're 100% permanently disabled. Senator Marty sent it here, even though it's being the fiscal note is actually to the Game and Fish Fund. I believe DNR is here. Imagine Public Safety is here. My constituent is not.
Thank you.
He's a bit frustrated that it's this hard.
Thank you, Senator Bach. That is understandable. Welcome, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services in the Department of Public Safety. The department does not have any fiscal costs with the amendment that was added with the effective date change. The effective date change is in 2016, and there's two reasons for it. The main reason is that the department has just started an RFP process for our new driver's license card. And so at this point in time, if we would put it on the current card, there would be a substantial cost because that's our current contract. And so by moving the date out, which is in the first engrossment, we would not have that problem. As all of the members know in this committee, also we're in the process of the MNLARS project. The driver's license release is release 3, and that would probably coincide with about the time that the card contract gets implemented, because that's a lengthy process to go through that particular RFP. So that was the date that was agreed upon with the authors, and so that's why that is in there. The Department of DVS has no fiscal note. We can do this as part of the process as long as we have that effective date, because otherwise there would be costs with the current card vendor. And then there, it would be challenging for in our current system to be making these changes. But certainly we're willing to work with the DNR and get this implemented. And that was, we worked specifically with Representative Dill, and he was okay with waiting that long. And I haven't had discussions with
Senator Bach, but I'm assuming that we can work things out if we need to, but that's the date that we put down in the bill.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the record. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. We are working with DPS and the author to address his concerns. We feel we can adapt our licensing program to deal with the 100% disabled licenses. There's some other ones that we need to work through. We're working through the costs are being tracked, I believe, through Senator Tomasoni's committee, and this bill will probably line up in the game of fish bill. At least that's where it should end up. And by doing so and working with DPS, we can drive down that fiscal note substantially, and we would take those costs out of the game of fish when they would be absorbed there.
Thank you. Senator Bach, any other comments?
Madam Chair, I guess my request is that the committee decided to pass the bill, they send it to finance, and then when the game and fish bill policy, it'll have to go to finance, and hopefully line it up there, and I believe that's the other bodies also carrying it.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Senator Sendrum?
Madam Chair, thank you, and I'll certainly support the bill, but I do have kind of a curiosity question. We had a lot of discussion the other day about selling by bulk driver's license information, and so if we were to add this element to the driver's license, we would, in effect, be making available to those that want to buy it lists of everybody that's, or could at least, be selling lists of everybody that's 100% disabled in Minnesota that has a driver's license. I don't know if you can drive. Can you drive if you're 100% disabled? It depends on disability, I suppose.
Ms. McCormick.
You get a Minnesota ID.
Madam Chair and Senator Sendrum, yes, you could be get an identification card under this bill as well as a driver's license. So if you were, obviously, if you were blind or your vision was impaired as such that you wouldn't be able to drive, you could still have the designation on your ID card.
Okay.
So because the card contract is not just for driver's licenses, but it's also for identification cards.
So marketers could then market to a disabled community, which I'm not saying is wrong. It just, I hadn't thought about it much before.
Madam Chair and Senator Sendrum, yes, that would be data.
Okay.
It's usually data on the card, yes.
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair. That presents a conundrum, as all of our electronic licensing data held by the DNR is considered private data under statute. So we would have to try to figure out how that would be dealt with. The legislature has made a determination that all of the licensing data that we have on snowmobiles, boats, ATVs, hunting information is private data. So we cannot release that except for certain cases. So we would have to try to – you raise a very good point, Senator, and it's one that we'd have to try to unweave somehow under if that were to be the case.
Ms. McCormick.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, obviously if the DNR has that as their statute, we would comply with what the DNR's in terms of if it's private under state statute any place, then we're not going to release that data. We would not release it. We do not usually release any kind of medical information, but if it would meet a permissible use in the federal code, that would be the federal code may say that we could release it to specific people that needed that purpose. But it would seem to me if there's a state statute that doesn't allow it in the DNR, then it would not be allowed by DVSs either.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick.
And Madam Chair, it's also possible in a future stop maybe to just classify this as private data, if you want to be absolutely sure.
Senator, I'd like to stay out of the
I forgot about that, Senator. I guess that. If we can do it without it, if we can do it without it.
Sounds like current statute might take care of this, so thank you. Members, any other additional questions? Senator Reinert, would you like to make a motion on this one? Someone want to make? Senator Wigger moves Senate File 2663 to be recommended to pass and referred to finance. Yes, thanks. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed. Motion passed. Senator Jensen.
That's okay.
Senator Jensen with Senate File 2795.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. This bill and the couple that follow will improve the state's emergency preparation and ability to respond to recent concerns over shipping crude oil through the state. Over the past decade, development in the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota have increased the amount of crude oil moving out of that region to refineries to the east and south. Pipelines carrying oil have been stretched to their limits, and railroads have been called on to transport increasing amounts of crude by rail. Since 2008, the number of tanker cars hauling crude oil have increased 40-fold to an estimated 400,000 cars annually, and that trend will continue. Over the next decade, oil-based shipments are forecast to increase another four times from the current 1 million barrels per day to more than 4.5 million barrels per day. While both railroads and pipelines have impressive safety records, recent incidents have increased the public awareness of what can happen should a spill or an accident occur. An explosion of tank cars near Castleton, North Dakota in December focused public attention and produced a demand for better coordination, prevention, and response efforts by local, state, and federal government. The Federal Railroad Administration recently announced an agreement with the Association of American Railroads that will institute a number of voluntary operating practices for moving crude by rail, including increased track inspections, track side technology, lowered operating speeds, increased first responder training, and development of an emergency response inventory along routes where crude is shipped. Senate File 2795 will step up efforts to prevent accidents from happening by first increasing the number of rail safety inspectors, performing a study on highway rail crossing improvements, and appropriating money to improve crossings in need of repair. We need to move Minnesota forward in preventing the disasters we've seen elsewhere, and this bill takes us in the right direction. I can walk through the bill. Section 1 increases the number of rail safety inspectors from 1 to 3 or 4 at the discretion of the Commissioner of Transportation. It provides rail safety inspectors and gives them the power to perform the duties described in the Federal State Rail Safety Participation Program. Section 2 changes the assessment on railroad companies to be divided by state rail safety inspector program costs in equal proportion between carriers. 50% would be rail based on the number of miles that they carry crude, and between pipelines based on the amount of oil the gallons that they send through the state. Section 3 establishes a study on highway rail grade crossing improvement for oil and other hazardous materials transported by rail. At a minimum, it should provide risk management information for oil transport, criteria for prioritizing improvements, and consider alternatives for safety improvements. Section 4 provides a one-time appropriation of $5 million for the development and implementation of safety improvements. And with that, we can have some testimony on the bill.
Testimony on the bill. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. I'm Philip Qualley, State Director for the United Transportation Union, Rail Division of the Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transit Union, representing the safety of workers in Minnesota. My comments today, I hope, will suffice for the three bills that will be before you. I was just hoping to give some context as we go forward today. At the outset, I would like to state clearly that oil and other hazmat materials have been moved safely on the railroad for decades. Oil is being moved safely by our crews at this moment, and we will be moving oil and hazmat materials years from now. However, incidents of derailment do occur, and we must be prepared. UTU supports the intent of this legislation to protect public safety. We welcome our state's interest in this safety area that has been in our charge, has been one of our grave concerns for decades. We want to be clear. Lac Magnatic, Quebec, Castleton, North Dakota, 2013, Clara City, Minnesota, 2007, Minot train derailment, 2002. These train derailments were not accidents. These were incidents with a cause from a track, operational, or mechanical failure. Recently, BNSF spokesperson Amy McBeth correctly stated that 99.998% of shipments reached their destination without incident. As train crews, our mission is 100% without exception. Safety first means no incident. So this is where we're coming from in this discussion. We thank Senator Jensen for acting to assure the state is prepared. As context, I'd like to briefly outline the positive industry events that are occurring at the federal level and explain our railroad authority in Minnesota. UTU believes the acknowledgement by American Association of Railroads February 21st that railroads will take voluntary actions regarding oil unitrain shipments is a good first step. We are pleased that the DOT and PHMSA has issued emergency order requiring stringent testing of crude oil before shipment. This may lead to crude oil classifications from a Class 3 combustible up to a Class 2 or Class 1 hazard, with the correct MSDS information traveling with the oil train shipment. Also at the federal level, UTU supports retirement or retrofitting of the DOT 111 type tank car. We are encouraged by BNSF's announcement that they will purchase 5,000 DOT 1232 tank cars. However, the replacement and retrofitting of tank cars will take years, and tens of thousands of DOT 111 single-hulled tank cars will remain in service on our main lines. UTU strongly supports the increased mechanical inspections of trains and increased track inspections, particularly those with inspectors immediately in advance of our hazmat unit train movements. We strongly support a federal order or regulation requiring a 5-car buffer between the first loaded hazmat car and an occupied locomotive on all hazmat unit trains. We also want to cite that within our industry, management must continue to work to improve fatigue issues for train crews with accurate, realistic, actively managed train lineups from which our crews can plan rest before calls to duty. We would also like to note that when the Rail Safety Improvement Act of 2008 and the mandate for every occupied locomotive cab to have emergency portable inhalation respirators, we still do not have that safety equipment due to delays in federal rulemaking. And finally, from the federal level, UTU wants to cite the importance of passage of House File 3040, the Safe Freight Act, which will mandate 2-person crews. With a certified conductor and engineer, train securement can be executed. In-cab crew resource management continues at current procedural levels, and public safety is assured. Regarding movements of trains, it is the conductor who has the authority for the train. When a hazmat derailment occurs, our first charge is to get our train's paperwork to the emergency responders. By federal regulation, it is the conductor who has the most recently updated, fully accurate, detailed train list with the train's cargo and hazmat placement. We have seen where railroad computer systems and centers have not updated train lists while the train is en route. So again, our first charge is to deliver the hazmat documents to the first responder, assess the hazmat material, instruct evacuation with direction and minimum perimeters. At the state level, UTU strongly supports passage of Senate File 2795 and associated bills that will bolster first responder preparedness with high-pressure fire equipment, fire suppressant materials, protective body suits for cities and smaller towns alike where trains travel, and assure an all-hazards approach that includes emergency alert systems with public response plans. Finally, it is our hope that all parties will continue to work in a cooperative and collaborative manner. UTU hopes to continue to be a part of any advisory, ongoing advisory, or planning group. Whatever the public opinion regarding oil and hazardous materials, we will continue to move these commodities by rail. While we need to guard against needless alarmism, I respectfully submit to the legislature that we move with urgency. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Any questions for the testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Pedersen.
Thank you, Senator Jensen, Mr. Qualley. So from your perspective, you feel like you've, my understanding is your union would be heavily involved in training. You feel like you've been involved in this bill up to this point in terms of implementing some of the training and requirements that that we're going to be asked to, that this bill is going to ask you to do?
Mr. Pauley.
Mr. Chairman, committee member, we have been in an advisory role on the outside of the conversations as the committee put the bill together. That is fine with us. There are hazardous material and first emergency response professionals that really know their stuff. We have an independent working relationship with them. We have confidence in this bill and the plan that and the outline that's been put together, yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, so my understanding in preparation for this hearing, I found a Star Tribune article that said here there's an attorney from Minnesota 350 was involved in drafting this legislation. Have you met with Minnesota 350 and talked about some of these issues?
Mr. Chairman, committee, I have not. I do not have a working relationship with Minnesota 350. I will say that the UTU does train our own conductors at the National Labor College in Silver Springs, Maryland. We feel so strongly that each local has our own conductors. We pay for our own conductors to go out and take on hands-on, in-depth, week-long training in hazardous material response and actually going into hazardous material sites. But to your question, Senator, we're confident in the way this bill has been constructed, and we've not been at the center of this writing of the legislation, no.
Thank you. Senator Mr. Chair, well, Mr. Qualley and Senator Jensen, when I first read that, I went to their website, and the very first, under their news releases, their very first priority is to retire Sherco 1 and 2 power plants in Becker. You know, in terms of the trains that are going into that facility, that's the goal of Minnesota 350. It's the first thing on their website. Is your union aware of that?
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, and I'm not sure that that is germane to this discussion. We certainly don't agree with that. Coal is an important commodity that we haul. It is 20% of our jobs. It is 40% of our industry's revenues, and we have really no standing affiliation with this group you're speaking of.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pedersen.
Yeah, Senator Jensen and Mr. Qualley, their second priority on their website is Minnesota tar sands, which is the elimination of the Keystone Pipeline project. Were you aware of that? Or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pedersen, I have not looked at their website, and that's not anything to do with 2795, 96, or 97.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, I'm using the Star Tribune as a resource. It says that Minnesota 350's group's attorney, Paul Blackburn, is helping legislators draft this language. So is it your position that Minnesota 350 has not helped you draft this language?
Senator Mr. Jensen. Chair and Senator Pedersen, I have not had contact or conversations in regards to this particular language with Minnesota 350.
Right. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
It is my understanding, though, Senator Pedersen, that they were not on the drafting committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, thank you. Yep, I was just using the Star Tribune article as my source for that information, and I'm glad to hear that's not true.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sort of curious why we haven't heard from the Minnesota Department of Transportation on this subject, considering we're making it from one position to three or four positions. And I'd certainly like to have an explanation why they think that they need this additional resources and they can't handle it under current existing positions.
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'll let the department speak for themselves, but I will tell you that as state director for the railroad workers, much of what we do is trying to work with the railroad carriers for safety in partnership. We also work with the Federal Railroad Administration on a regular basis. when necessary. Our railroad workers have us write complaints in terms of violations in the six disciplines, including track, mechanical, motive power, operations, and so on and so forth, to assure railroad safety. I can tell you that from my knowledge, respectfully, the Federal Railroad Administration is understaffed. You have one or two track inspectors covering two or more states. And we were a party to helping craft legislation in 2008 that created the first state rail safety inspector. And we strongly support the addition of more track inspectors with MnDOT who are working in conjunction with the Federal Railroad Administration under 49 CFR 212 State Federal Partnerships Program. But the key piece is I really strongly submit to the legislature that of the department's inspectors that may be come forward, one be a hazmat inspector. We need a hazmat inspector in this state. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I want to hear from MnDOT. We got a 300 or 400% increase in positions here, and I need some justification why we're 300 or 400% understaffed in this situation.
Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gardner. I'm director of the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations at MnDOT, which includes all of our freight rail activities, including our state inspection program. We currently do have a single inspector under that program, which is a affiliate program of the Federal Railroad Administration. About 30 states participate in this program. Our inspector is focused on inspecting track work at this point, certified to do so by the FRA, works in conjunction with two other track inspectors of the Federal Railroad Administration, who also work in western Wisconsin.
Sir, be sure you're close to
the microphone.
Bring the microphone
up.
I'll try to compete with the drums. If additional inspectors were made available to us, we would want to pursue a hazmat certification for one of those inspectors. There has been a significant increase in the amount of hazardous materials that's being carried by rail, particularly Bakken and Cruel, which is especially volatile, on a couple of key train routes. There's also significant amounts of ethanol, anhydrous ammonia, and numerous other chemicals moving in the state. Minnesota has a rail network of 4,500 miles, which is the eighth largest in the country. We have about 18 railroads operating over that network. The railroads are required to do a certain level of inspection themselves. They do a very good job with that, but as a system under stress. The railroads are doing quite well. It's very successful. The traffic is growing. Short lines still, in particular, have significant infrastructure that's quite old and in need of upgrade. For example, about one-third of all of the short line track in Minnesota does not currently meet modern standards and needs investment. And so if additional inspectors were made available to us, we think we could put them to good use.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osme.
Thank you. Question as to, you know, we were presented a number of different train derailments at the beginning of this presentation. Are you saying that if we had additional staff, none of those would have been prevented, or are you also saying that if we increased by 300 or 400%, we still may have a derailment?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, certainly there could be no guarantees that we would no longer have derailments, which are the primary cause of derailments, according to federal research, is derailments. There are other factors where there might be causing release of hazardous materials. But the primary causal factor of derailments is the track condition. And so additional inspections can identify defects in rail. Due to environmental conditions, due to the age of the rail, due to the stress from rail traffic, of course. And other causes include mechanical problems with the trains themselves, flat spots on wheels and so forth, as well as human error of driving too fast, if you will. So there can be a combination of factors, but certainly would help to manage the risk that's associated with derailments.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosmick.
Sorry, I'm being distracted. I'll come back. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosmick, the reason that I spoke about those is because that is what brings more public awareness and made us have to take a look at, are we prepared in case of those incidents? Not necessarily that we would be able to have prevented them in any way, but are we ready and are we prepared? And that's what these bills address.
Follow up, Senator Rosmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with you. We should always be prepared, but that also comes in light of the fact that we can never be prepared for everything. Question back to the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Is it not true that the rail companies themselves perform these basic inspections or continuous inspections of their existing track, where it would be in their best interest to find these before they occurred? And wouldn't they actually have an inherent benefit or inherent self-interest in this, so that we may not necessarily need as much inspections because they're doing it?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's absolutely true. The railroads do a good job of maintaining their system. Nonetheless, a certain amount of independent oversight has proven to be fairly productive. For example, last year, the inspections by the Federal Railroad Administration identified over 5,000 rail defects, as they're called, and about 150 instances of more serious violations, which are nonconformance with federal standards, about 150 such violations. Railroads have, in fact, been fined millions of dollars by the FRA across the country for not correcting those in a timely manner. But at its core, this is a partnership program to work together with the federal officials and the railroads to ensure as safe a system as possible.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosmick, one of the problems that we have is the changing environment that is happening within the oil industry and some of those things. 40% increase and a 4 times in pipeline forces us basically to make sure, especially with the kind of crude that's coming now, that's more volatile and create they're more explosive. So even if we can prevent one, it would pay for itself many times over for many, many years.
Well,
Senator Rosmick.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Jensen, we could spend a lot of money making things 100% safe, but we would be spending a lot of money. And what I'm trying to get to is how much, I guess, back to your testifier to the Minnesota Department of Transportation, I mean, how many miles or what is the average inspection that the rail companies do, and how much additional inspection would we see to the same track or going over the same territory that these positions would do? In other words, what bang for my buck beyond what the train companies are already doing are we going to actually see?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have consulted with the Federal Railroad Administration about the relationship between the inspections that are done under this program versus what the railroads do. And while a small portion of the work by the public inspectors is to ensure that the defects that have been discovered by the railroads are in fact being corrected, the vast majority of the work is to supplement the number of inspections, not duplicate the inspections. I don't have the precise numbers on particularly the railroad inspections that have occurred. The federal inspectors filed with MnDOT's inspector about 1,000 inspection reports last year. We have statistics on, as I mentioned, number of defects and violations that were found. I don't have comparable numbers on the results or numbers of the inspections that the railroads themselves have filed with the Federal Railroad Administration.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Minnesota Department of Transportation, I have a question for you. It says here that the state rail safety inspector may perform, but is not limited to, the duties described in the federal state rail safety participation program. My first question is, but not limited to, what other duties other than what is described in the participation program do you have in mind?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are certain other duties that the state inspectors are involved in. One is to enforce some state statutes that pertain to rail safety. For example, walkway clearances, train clearances. The inspector deals with various complaints that are received from the public, from the shipping community, about rail issues. And so they do have a certain amount of other duties that that they do fulfill.
Okay. Well, I'm Mr. Kiffmeyer. Chairman, I'll just share just my concern, because I know that this is a fairly visible situation that we're in, and sometimes what happens is we have a reaction, and what I'm looking for is a good methodical response, but not a reaction that ends up hampering a very important segment. I mean, I hear from people about needing delivery of oil and oil products, and you know, these things being slowed down and not getting the products they need for heating and for uses for their home. And so I just have a concern here that we end up really disrupting a supply chain. And so we have maybe some situations here to be included, but I also note that there's a fair amount of additional activities being included here, and including track, signal, train control, motive power and equipment, operating practices, compliance, hazardous material, and highway rail grade crossings. And then we have, below that, we have another study, and we have money appropriated. So, and they have the power to issue citations. So I appreciate some of the efforts here, but those are my concerns.
Senator Peterson, then Senator France.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think others have established that the railroad companies and the workers probably want to prevent accidents and derailments more than anyone else. But the question I have for the Department of Transportation, who actually pays for a cleanup? If there's a derailment and a spill, who actually pays for that?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not familiar. We don't get involved in the that end of response or remediation, certainly on the environmental side. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, I'll wait till I'm guessing we have other testifiers coming. I'll ask that question later. For Senator Jensen, you know, there's other forms of transportation for these hazardous materials. And mainly trucks and barges. Do you have plans for the trucking industry and the barge industry to do something similar in regards to this effort that you're working on here for pipelines and for railroads?
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, these bills deal with rail and pipeline, and that these are the bills that we need to take a look at because of the things that we've been talking about.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair. Jensen. Senator Jensen, that was my question. If your office has plans for similar bills for trucking and for barges.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, Senator my office has no intention of doing another bill regarding trucks or when it comes to hazardous material or oil.
Okay. You know, the concern,
Senator Peterson.
Yes, so Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, the concern I have is in finance earlier this year, just a few weeks ago, we heard testimony in regards to the propane shortage and one of the reasons why we have that shortage and the significant cost we do for that material is because one of the pipelines that brings propane into Minnesota is being reversed and taking material the other direction. So our assumption is, I think, and the Department of Commerce assumption is that propane that we're losing, and so the propane issue is not going to go away next winter or the winter after, quite frankly, is going to move to trucks. And so we have a material, hazardous material, that's going to be transported in vehicles rather than pipelines. And I'm concerned that with regulations like this, we're discouraging pipeline companies to meet the needs of Minnesota. And quite frankly, in this case, they've already made a decision to not bring propane to Minnesota for some other reason. And as Senator Kiffmeyer pointed out, is going to do nothing but drive up the cost for our residents. So it's your intention. Do you believe these bills are going to raise the cost of energy for Minnesotans?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I believe the intention of these bills is to make sure that however the materials are transported via rail or via pipeline, that it is safe and that we are prepared to deal with an incident should it occur.
Thank you.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Jensen or anyone. I'm trying to maybe understand this a little bit from the standpoint of just overall need. And Senator Jensen, as you and know, in our neck of the woods, so to speak, we have a lot of ethanol, millions of gallons, hundreds of train cars going through both Rochester and Owatonna, and at least in terms of my memory, although I think I can remember one derailment in Cass, and there may have been more, I don't know. But my question is, and maybe this is to the MnDOT individual, as Senator Peterson has pointed out, the incentive to have quality tracks and to prevent derailment is first and foremost on the shoulders of the railroad itself. They don't want these things any more than anybody else, but particularly they don't want. There's public relations issues. There's issues related to just the delivery of product and economic issues and so on and so forth. So I got to believe that most railroads have a pretty intensive track inspection program. As I recall, in Rochester at least, that pickup's going up and down, the DM&E lines almost very regularly, at least. I'm not sure if not daily or more. But can you give us some idea what the intensity of a rail company's inspection program would be? I mean, I would believe there's some level of requirement there, isn't that not the case?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that yes, there is a required base level of inspections that the railroads are required to perform. That varies with the size of the railroad, for example. The class ones are the great big railroads. We have a number of small railroads that don't have quite the same capacity, of course, as the larger railroads. But as I mentioned before, the railroads do a good job of maintaining their track and inspecting their track. And the intent of the public inspection program, if you will, is to supplement those efforts and to try to identify additional defects and problem areas. Railroad operations have many moving parts, obviously, and in terms of infrastructure, and rolling stock, and yards, and terminals, operating procedures. There's a number of federal regulations that are in place, and the enforcement of those regulations is really left up to the Federal Railroad Administration, supplemented by the state inspectors who represent about a third nationwide of that overall inspection force. About 30 states have these programs in place, and the size of the individual state programs really varies with the magnitude of the railroad operations and the quantity of the tonnage that's moving in any particular state.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I can think better by example, but just for instance, you may be we have a line that crisscrosses Minnesota and in southern Minnesota. The Canadian Pacific used to be DM&E. And I don't know if that's class one or two or three or whatever, but a casually active line, I think there's two trains a day going through Rochester. What level of inspection might that get from the state? And I'm believing that it must get daily inspection from the railroad company, but I'm just trying to get to the question, how much of this would be enhanced if we went ahead with this bill? I mean, would we, on this track and any other track in Minnesota, see profoundly different and new inspections that would be demonstrably better? Or are we just, is this so incremental in terms of an increase in overall inspections that it almost doesn't matter?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is a strategy to how these inspections are conducted by the public inspectors. They They identify likely problem areas based on past evidence, based on reports from the railroads, and really try to concentrate on sort of the weak links in the system, in the structures, in the rail, within yards, where this material is switched between train and by truck. And we have had some leakage problems there, checking some of the tanker cars for leaking seals. Make sure that they're placarded correctly, they're identified so that responders know what they're dealing with when there is an incident. So there's a number of needs that exist in the system. They try to prioritize those needs. And again, in consulting with the FRA, they are very supportive of us enhancing our program because of their limited ability in terms of their resource to do what's necessary to enforce those federal regulations.
Okay, and maybe one more, Senator, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen or anyone else, would this bill, we speak of oil and things like that, but, ethanol, soybean oil, anything other than oil that we think of it, at least in terms of crude oil, this would apply to almost any flammable or otherwise hazardous material? Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, what this bill is talking about is to do inspection on the tracks,
right,
and to make improvements. So that would be the overall is to make sure that the track is prepared,
okay,
and there is safety measures in place and that we have some people to do some of those inspections and that the study would take place to make sure that the tracks are prepared.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I'm sure every track in Minnesota does carry at some point in time some level of hazardous material. So we're talking just broadly. We're not necessarily talking about the mainline oil tracks through Minnesota or anything. We're talking every track in Minnesota. Is that right?
Well,
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, hazmat is not necessarily moving on all rail lines in the state. It's certainly moving on these key oil train routes that are carried by the BNSF and the Canadian Pacific. We also have ethanol moving on railroads like the TC&W.
Yeah.
So and we have smaller lots of anhydrous, of propane. Because of the shutdown of the pipeline for propane, we do know that some of the major players have leased hundreds of rail cars to carry propane in the future. So we expect to see some significant movements of propane by rail in the coming years as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're still not getting the answer to the question that Senator Senjum is saying. Let me boil it down more specifically. And Senator Jensen, you can answer this or whoever. How often are tracks being inspected in the state of Minnesota now by the railroads and by the state, and how much more or how more often will we have tracks inspected in the state of Minnesota as a result of this legislation?
Mr. Gardner. Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, Senator, tracks are being inspected daily. Those inspections, the frequency of those inspections are highest on the oil train routes, for example, and where there are hazardous materials movements as required by federal law. I don't have the specific number of people that are involved in those activities or inspection reports that are filed on the private side that may be available through the FRA. We do know those numbers for the public inspector. I don't necessarily have it on without calculating it on a rate basis, inspections per track mile, for example, which we could readily try to calculate. But again, it's a supplementary activity. It's helping to ensure that the railroads are correcting the defects that they find and also identifying additional problem areas that can be corrected.
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for your question. Questions well put. I guess from the department's perspective, very clear and concise answer, but I have to tell you from the practical standpoint for those of us railroad workers out on the lines, let us share with you what we know. First of all, there's no one who wants to expedite freight train movement more than conductors and train crews. That's our job. But we are very concerned at the level of track inspections and mechanical inspections and motive power inspections in this state. Piece that you need to know is that under the Federal Railroad Administration regulations on continuous welded rail, which is called CWR, it's called ribbon rail, they're quarter-mile welded rail segments of track that are jointed and then move on from there. What the federal regulation, there is no federal regulation on the continuous welded rail itself. There's only the regulation that the carrier has to submit a continuous welded program to the FRA, have the FRA approve the program, and then only that the carrier live up to its own continuous welded rail program. We think that the addition of inspectors will greatly enhance and increase inspections to assure the track safety. Let me give a specific example. We try to keep information somewhat privileged in our industry. We are a security industry. However, on the Union Pacific Railway, south of Worthington, there were 5 derailments in approximately a 9-month period on a small level, a short segment of track at the Iowa border. We filed federal complaints on these track derailments, and yet the FRA found no actual complaint violation with the track condition. However, the FRA did find a violation in the records of the company. The records, the carriers were not keeping their record keeping up to date and proper. So this is an example where the state safety inspector can assist. Another example is that on the Canadian Pacific Railway, including the DM&E, we have track inspectors who are reporting to us that while they'll go out and inspect the track, they're under time production, they're under time constraints to cover so many miles, and they've had instances where they've put in a slow order, which means they call it in to slow the speed on a track, and someone in the Canadian Pacific management has come back and arbitrarily raised the speed on them. So, I mean, these are real concerns that we have inside the processes of the company that we feel the state rail safety inspector can improve. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Kiffmeyer's questions and the disciplines that she read, those are all motive power, mechanical, and so on, are disciplines that are associated in the federal program at 212, 49 CFR 212. And we would very much appreciate department having the ability to have an inspector go out and work with shippers regarding hazmat containment and sealing of cars. We've had 3 workers at BNSF Northtown Yard in the last 16 months who were exposed to hazardous materials from cars that had not been sealed properly. We have encouraged the carriers to go out and continually to go to industries and train them and assure their cars and valve hatches are being sealed properly before release. It's the nature of our business. People are going to get hurt. Incidents are going to happen. Our mission is 100% safety. So a rail safety inspector would greatly be a great benefit to the public of Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Jensen. Anything further? All right. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we still have the testifiers up there, especially the gentleman from MnDOT, how did we arrive at the $5 million number? How do we know, is that enough or not enough for this safety program?
Mr. Gardner, and I'll take a stab at it. It's not enough, but it's a start. There's a lot of grade crossings that need to be done. Mr. Gardner.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator, I would concur that it's essentially a start. On these key oil train routes, there are 112 crossings that do not have what we call active protection. In other words, don't have gates or signals. They're simply crossbuck signs at those locations. And that $5 million would allow for, if we were to do full-blown gate and signal systems, would allow for about 18 additional installations along those routes. But what we would like to do is to do a full study of the corridors to look at various improvement strategies, including potentially closing some of these crossings, some of which are rural and rather low in terms of cross-traffic, vehicular traffic. We have had some incidents, particularly with farm trucks and agricultural trucks, that are frequently crossing these tracks, that we feel that there does need to be improvement at some of these crossings. Last year we had a truck carrying anhydrous ammonia that hit a train. The driver was killed, and there was a release of the anhydrous. So, you know, anhydrous tanker truck hitting Bakken oil crude train truck at a higher speed, I don't know what the consequences would be, but it probably is not a good scenario. So we feel that we want to take a comprehensive look and look at the risks along the corridor, to look at adjacent land uses, to the nature of the traffic that's crossing, and look at a variety of strategies for trying to improve safety at the grade crossings, which is one of our traditional roles at the department. About one-third of all the grade crossings in the state have some kind of active protection. Many do not.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, so you feel that the $5 million would cover roughly 18 of those crossings, and what was the total amount? 18 of how many? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's Jordan. Currently about 112 locations that do not have gates and signals, and part of that analysis looks at the cost-benefit of putting those systems in, the volume of cross-traffic, the speeds of the trains, and so forth.
Well, Mr. Chair, and coming from a community that has a lot of railroad tracks, and we see increased volume of not only the crude oil, I talked to some of our local safety folks, firefighters, and their concern isn't as much with the oil as it is some of the other products that are coming through that are more hazardous. So, Mr. Chair, I agree with you. I don't think $5 million is enough. Is nearly enough. I would like to see that amount increased. I'm not sure to how much, and I'm not sure what our target looks like. But I'm comfortable increasing that amount.
Well, Senator Miller, I'm not totally sure what our target is either. We'll find out soon, and this will be in the finance article that will be carried in the supplemental budget. And if we can, humanly possible, we'll post that in advance, of course, and then we'll have it, and we'll see it on Friday in this committee, and then we'll have markup on Monday. So you'll have an opportunity to
Mr. Chair, knowing that, unfortunately, I have a scheduling conflict on Friday, so I don't think I will be here. I'd like to offer an amendment.
Well, Senator Miller, markup will be on Monday.
Be on Monday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you can make a motion now.
Well, I'd like to make a motion to increase that funding, and I don't know how we came to the $5 million. It doesn't sound like we. It sounds like it's just a number, but it's not a number that's high enough. So. I'm going to make a suggestion that we increase it to $10 million. So I'd like to move that on line 3.9, we increase the $5 million to $10 million.
All right. We'll get there. We'll get
and then when your targets crossing. Come out, Mr. Chair, we'll see. Maybe we can increase it more from there.
Very good. All right. Any questions on the Miller motion? Senator Jensen, do you have a response?
Sure.
What the heck? Okay. All right, all in favor of the Miller motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
No. Motion passes.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Senator.
And you've been patient. And it's, as long as I'm this far into some of these questions, I just got maybe one final one, and you can answer it maybe just in a minute. I don't need anything prolonged. But it's how do you do an inspection? And I'm going to believe it's not a person walking down the middle of a railroad track, that it may be a pickup driving on tracks with maybe a camera mounted on the front bumper or something like that. But how physically do you do one if you're a railroad company? And how physically would you do one if you're the state of Minnesota? Is it the same inspection, in other words? But just how do you do it? Just
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, they are quite similar. Our inspector has the ability to high rail, as you call it, to drive his pickup truck on the tracks to go to certain locations. He gets out. He inspects physically, does some walking, does some inspection, works in, does yard inspections as well. many times is accompanied by the railroad maintenance folks who want to understand what the issues are out there, and there's communications with them. So it's they also, our inspector also works with the Federal Railroad Administration to use what's called a geometry car, a car that can essentially use ultrasound to look inside the rails. Okay. That is occasionally brought through the state and used particularly on some of these significant routes carrying hazardous materials. So it's sort of a variety of techniques that they use.
And thank you. And that's helpful. I don't need to prolong it.
Great. Great. Thanks. Anything further, members? If we're ready to make a motion on this. Did anyone else want to come to the table on this bill? No. Okay. Senator Jensen, do you have a motion?
Yes, I move that Senate File 2795 be laid over. Is it laid over, or where does it go?
As amended.
As amended.
Mr. Chair.
As amended.
Oh. I don't want to interrupt. I think we have someone who does want to testify. I just saw his hand go up. So.
All right.
Okay.
Just want to make sure the public has their opportunity.
Thank you, Senator Miller. Welcome to the committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks for letting me testify to you today. My name is Peter Lidiak, and I'm with the American Petroleum Institute. API represents about 580 corporate members engaged in all aspects of the oil and natural gas industry. And that includes pipeline transportation. And I have a few concerns with this bill that I'd like to highlight for you today. One thing I certainly want to make sure that the committee understands, and that I think some of the members already brought to light, is that because of the definition of what oil is and what hazardous materials are, this certainly is going to include crude oil. It's going to include refined products. It's also going to include ethanol and some of the other things that have been discussed. So that ought to be clear. And certainly then it pulls in all sorts of pipelines, not just crude oil pipelines. Pipeline safety for operators is the highest goal. We have a goal of zero incidents. That is no spills, no injuries, no operational upsets for our customers. In 2012, we moved more than 14 billion barrels of liquid products through the pipeline network across the U.S., and 99.999% of that and more made it to its destination without incident. From 2001 to 2012, the number of spills that we experienced dropped by 62%, and the volume spill dropped by 47%. And the reason for that is that the industry, working with our regulators, has done a better job of looking at where those problems lie. Releases caused by corrosion, as an example, have been reduced by nearly 80%. And that is a cause that is often associated with crude oil pipelines. While these numbers are all impressive, we're not at zero yet. And we are going to continue to strive for zero. And so we certainly agree with the intent of any bill that is going to improve pipeline safety. We're not convinced this bill is going to get us there. Job one in our business is to actually make sure that the stuff stays in the pipe.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
So, I'm sorry to interrupt, but is this testifier coming to the pipeline bill that's coming, or is this
right.
germane?
I was just scouring the bill to see if there's any pipeline provisions in this particular bill. This bill is confined just to rail transportation.
Thank you.
All right. So. You got a head start on your testimony.
Good, I'll restart on it.
All right.
But I'll take it up where I left
off, right,
so
very
we
good.
Don't waste
very
time.
Good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Senator Osmick. I was just trying to figure it out. I was just about to do that. All right, so Senator Jensen renews her motion. We can forward it to
finance.
We can refer it to finance, yeah.
As amended.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed no?
No.
Motion carries. All right. All right, moving on. 2796, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2795 looked at prevention and preparedness and response by doing study on rail. 2796 looks at what the state can do for our first responders, those that respond in case when a something happens. What it does is it creates a railroad and pipeline safety account to be used for training and response preparedness. I do have an amendment. I'd like to introduce the A1.
Senator Jensen moves the A1 amendment. While it's being distributed, you want to speak to it. Senator
Jensen. Yes. Section 1, well, the amendment deletes Section 2 and Section 3 of the bill and adds a pipeline safety account. And that fund would be used to train first responders and firefighters on how to handle a derailment spill or oil or hazardous material fire.
Okay. Question, does everyone have the amendment? Questions on the amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Senator Jensen.
Thank you. Then to the bill. Section 1 establishes the duties of the Commissioner of Public Safety related to spills, including assisting local emergency managers and fire departments to understand hazards and general strategies, assisting railroads and pipeline companies to develop protocols for first responders, facilitates cooperation between railroad pipeline companies, emergency managers, and other public safety organizations, participating in major exercises and training sessions, assisting local governments to incorporate hazardous in response information for their local plans, monitoring the public safety related in requirements in 115E.03, which is the section that we're talking about. Section 2 then creates a railroad and pipeline safety account in a special revenue fund. 3, the fund would be used for funding training and response readiness for train derailments and pipeline discharges of oil and other hazardous substances. Funds can be distributed by the Board of Firefighting Training and Education or the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Subdivision 4, the Commissioner of Public Safety will assess $2.5 million to railroad and pipeline companies as provided in the formula. Railroads would be assessed 50%. Between carriers, based on the route miles operated in Minnesota. Pipelines assess 50% of the total, divided in equal proportion between companies based on their yearly aggregate gallons of oil transported in Minnesota. And finally, Section 4 provides for a one-time $2.5 million appropriation to the Railroad and Pipeline Safety Account. With that, we could have some testimony on the bill.
Thank you.
Maybe Philip Qualley from the United Transportation Union. Oh, you did. Oh, that's right. Dave Brown, Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairwoman and committee members, my name is Dave Brown. I'm with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. We're an organization that was created back in 1863 to represent locomotive engineers. We are the I am the state legislative chairman for the state of Minnesota, also the National Region 3 legislative chairman. Representing the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, that is the division of the Teamsters Rail Conference of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. BLET and Teamsters helped create the grant funding and the training program that was located in Silver Springs, Maryland. That program continues through the Rail Workers Hazardous Material Program with the Hazmat Chemical Emergency Response Training in Houston, Texas. With the assistance of the BLET and the Teamsters, we are working with the International Association of Firefighters to continue our work and the work of rail labor to provide what the carriers have failed in providing. Our two organizations have recently been awarded a grant to continue this work, but this work and training only gets to a small percentage of rail workers. With that said, to make this this testimony short, with that said, we need the carriers, order producers, and shippers to step up and provide classroom and field training. They need to work in conjunction with the emergency personnel to provide the equipment necessary to safely evaluate and in any undesired release of hazardous material from any container at any location. They need to build access roads in the yards that would accommodate first responders and their equipment in train staging locations. A case in point is the Canadian Pacific Railway Yard in Pig's Eye, St. Paul, between Dunn Yard and CP South St. Paul. That access road was replaced by a track that was built abutting the riverfront. If done legally or illegally, it was not properly evaluated or vetted with the first responder personnel. The BNSF Railway Northtown Yard in Minneapolis closed all access from East River Road on the west side of the yard completely without accommodating for larger emergency personnel response equipment on the east side of the yard to access the entire yard, again, without properly vetting with the first responder personnel. We need to see an increase and the schedule for track inspections with an increase of track inspector personnel, their daily inspections, and territory covered. Step up the ranks of maintenance away track personnel in order to maintain and to properly fix any problem track at switches. Boost geometry car inspections of the tracks to a quarterly schedule. Our perception and that of rail labor and of these and other safety-related issues differs from that of the railroads. Our vision of safety comes from the rank and file, the backbone of this nation's railroads. It comes from the highly skilled, professional, hardworking men and women working days, nights, holidays, 24/7, 365 days a year, moving this nation's people and freight. We are the first responders to accidents and derailments by the very nature of our employment. We are uniquely positioned to provide good judgment and ideas regarding the types of changes and recommendations that would make our industry safer and more secure. The Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen will continue to seek opportunities to work with this committee, the carriers, and federal agencies on legislative and regulatory priorities that strengthen the safety of moving America's passengers from freight as a normal course of our activities. I want to thank the Madam Chairwoman and esteemed members of this committee for the opportunity to bring forth my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Questions, members, for this testifier? Okay, thank you. Is Mr. Franklin here? Anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. And on behalf of this bill, we appreciate the changes that have been made with this amendment. And I'll be very brief and concise. We'll continue to work with this. We think it's a great idea, and we want to continue to support the safety and the response to Minnesota. So with that, I'll just conclude in the interest of time.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Abbotts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Abbotts, Messerly & Kramer, on behalf of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association and a couple of the other railroads who are here today. I have representatives of the Class 1s, the larger railroads, Burlington Northern, Canadian Pacific, and Canadian National here as well. And if you have questions, we'd be happy to speak to any of those questions that might arise. I just want to mention something with regard to this particular piece of legislation. A good piece of legislation, and the railroads have been in discussion with the House author for quite a number of days with regard to provisions of it, as well as with the Department of Public Safety, firefighters, and a number of other folks who are interested in this particular piece of legislation. And one of the there's two provisions here. One of the provisions that is not in this, and we'd like to have it in there, and maybe we can work on that over time, is a provision that restricted the appropriations to Class 1s, larger railroads. The other issue is there was a sunset established in the House file. And the reason for that is essentially that without some sort of sunset, we've got a kind of an ongoing funding source of about $2.5 million that's going to be levied upon the industry, both the railroads and the pipeline industry, on
on into perpetuity, excuse me. We reached agreement on the other side, if you will, to of a 3 to 5 year sunset. And the rationale behind that was we don't know what's out there right now. We understand there are needs, and we do not discount what firefighters have said in terms of their needs for equipment. And certainly this fund, both the contribution by the state and the industry, will assist them in that. But let's take it out about 5 years and figure out what is really needed out there and how that would most appropriately be provided for and paid for. And so we just implore you that as this goes forward, you take a serious look at putting a sunset on at least the initial amount of payments that are made and do an assessment of that once as this goes on. I think there's a study in here that does assess how much material there is out there, how much material is needed, and how to maintain that material over time. And and that's what we're hoping that you take a consideration of.
Thank you, Mr. Abbott.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Willoughby, Director of Operations for Enbridge. I will be addressing only the proposed assessment. Enbridge is committed to public safety and goes to great lengths to ensure we operate safely and support our local emergency responders. We have numerous training and coordination activities underway. We do have several concerns with the proposed assessments that would create a significant expense for our company. We currently already pay an annual per-mile assessment through the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. That supports public safety in Minnesota. We also pay county taxes that support local communities, and we continue to expand our asset base, which is generating more revenue for these communities and counties. We also support our local emergency responders through our Safe Communities program, donating vehicles and equipment to the local fire departments and emergency responders, and offering training to responders. This in addition to coordination of response drills and activities that you will hear about in separate bill testimony. The bill proposes an assessment based on volume of liquid transported. As a large diameter pipeline operator with multiple pipelines in a common corridor, this would place a large cost burden on Enbridge, despite the fact that we operate through a limited, largely rural area. In effect, this fee is not equitably assessed based on the risks that Enbridge operations may pose as just one stakeholder in one industry. I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Willoughby, any questions, members? Thank you. All right. So I have Phil Qualley listed as a testifier to this bill and Brian Sweeney.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Philip Qualley, I'll defer my presentation. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway in St. Paul. I'd like to thank Senator Jensen for having taken the time earlier to talk with us about these bills. I'd first like to echo Mr. Appitz's comments regarding the moratorium. First, the rail industry does itself have stockpiles of equipment, emergency response equipment across our system. We have that available to use by by the public. We have understandings with the other railroads to share this equipment. They also have equipment in different locations. The moratorium, again, because right now there isn't even a grasp of what equipment is out there and is available, and to make these two industries the capital program for the fire departments in perpetuity just does not make sense. So the moratorium was what we came up with in the House as a reasonable compromise to that. But basically, we do, as I said, have equipment. We do take safety seriously. We provide training to emergency responders across our system, several hundred in the state of Minnesota in the last few years. We already have training sessions that have been conducted in Minnesota this year. We have more scheduled later on. We do work very closely with the local emergency responders on not only these areas, but as I said, equipment sharing and so on. And so for that reason, we ask that you put a moratorium on this tax. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Questions, members? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Sweeney, we're talking about $2.5 million worth of additional expenses that's going to be pushed upon private sector industry. Can you tell me what's going to happen? Are prices of freight going to go up? How is that going to be passed on to the consumer? Where is the money going to be coming from?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, ultimately every expense that a company incurs is passed on somehow to a consumer. That's just the way that things work. So, yes, there will be costs passed on. We do spend considerable amounts of money on safety ourselves. I'd like to point out we have a capital program system-wide of $5 billion a year, $5 billion for this year. Roughly half of our capital program usually is in track. We also invest in new equipment. We are pushing very aggressively to get rid of the older tank cars. For those who don't understand, the railroads do not own the tank cars that the oil moves in. Those are owned by either the shippers or they're leased from another party. The railroads have to take them in the containers that the so-called 111 tank car, because federal rule says that that's an acceptable car for this commodity. Until the federal rule is changed, and that's probably going to take a year, we have to take them in that container, and there will likely be a phase-out period. My company has announced that we would like to buy 5,000 tank cars ourselves. We're going to break with the norm in the industry, buy our own tank cars that are not only built to the standards of the 1232 cars, the stronger ones, but even beyond that, with even thicker steel, full head shields, thermal protection. So we're talking about a major investment in safety in that area. Also with the steady improvement in the safety record for the industry as a whole, and certainly for my company, the railroad industry has been putting money into safety.
So, Mr. Sweeney, I had a question about the tank cars that BNSF is purchasing, which I think is great, by the way. So then would you, maybe you just said this and I didn't quite hear it, would you then in turn make those available on a lease basis to your shippers?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, thanks.
And I should point out that right now roughly we estimate 60% or more of the Bakken oil is moving in the 1232 cars. There are still a number of the 111 cars out there in oil service, though. That number is going down as leases are coming up. People more and more are switching to the newer cars.
Mr. Sweeney, do I remember you telling, or did I read this in the paper, that, or maybe Mr. Appett said it, either you or some other carrier is going to be charging the shippers some premium for shipping in the 111 cars and not in the, like, $250 per car?
Mr. Chair, that's not us. I believe one of the other railroads here is doing that. But, yeah, the railroads are looking at different ways of inducing the shippers to use the newer cars.
Right, a cost which would probably be passed on to the consumer.
Right.
All right. Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Jensen, sounds like you could get quite a bit more peace in the valley if we had a sunset clause. Are you amenable to having that added to this bill?
Mr.
Senator
Chair
Jensen
and Senator Osmick, this is the first that I've heard about a sunset clause. I think it sounds fair.
Oh, okay. Senator Osmick. I'll work with Ms. Berzovsky and be right back.
All right. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Sweeney, I asked a question earlier. There was a lot of discussion about accidents. In fact, there was a number of derailments that were used as examples, and I think we heard testimony that there's nobody that wants to prevent that type of situation more than the railroad companies and the workers, and I think we all agree on that. But the question I'd ask, who actually pays for the cleanup when there is an accident? Who pays for that right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator, ultimately the rail carrier is responsible. There may be some settlement with the shipper or the owner of the tank car if there's a problem with how the commodity was packaged or whatever, but the railroad is on the front end of responsibility for the cleanup costs.
So, Mr. Chair, Sweeney, do you receive invoices from the communities for their first responder service and things like that?
Mr. Sweeney. Chair, Senator, yes. Typically, especially with the large situations such as Castleton, yes, we'll receive a claim from the city for whatever costs are incurred, including, you know, the pizzas that were donated for the I take that back. Somebody was actually nice enough to donate those. But, yes, we pay all the costs for this cost of city services, whatever facilities is being used for the headquarters and so on, we pay those bills.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, in the discussion, while you were out of the room, I was concerned that members of the committee were getting the impression that all these increased costs were needed for various reasons relating to the cleanup, and that's not accurate. Is my point in that there's no cost to the taxpayers for the cleanup. When an accident happens, certainly there's damage to the company's reputation and potentially loss of life and property and that type of thing. But I think it's important for members to note that right now there is no cost to the taxpayers from a financial standpoint when that happens. I have a question for Senator Jensen. Have you visited a pipeline and distribution center by any chance where a pipeline kind of comes in and they load the fuel and that type of thing? Have you had a chance to visit one of those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I have not.
Okay. Mr. Chair, here we have a case where we're listening to three bills that drastically impacts a number of industries. I have had a chance to visit the facility in Roseville, and I'm not sure who owns that or if any of those folks are here now. But one of the things that I took away from that tour, and I would make that suggestion for this committee in the future during the interim, it's unfortunate we're dealing with issues like this when not all senators on the committee have had a chance to actually visit a pipeline, for example, and where this fuel is loaded. One of the things that sticks out in my mind in particular when I was on that tour, there's a federal guideline that says they need to report if there's a spill of 5 gallons or more. Well, this particular company, again, I don't know who it is, but had an internal company policy that they report a spill of 1 gallon or more. And so I think that's an example. And all throughout the afternoon, there was examples that showed us that the industry is relating with these very serious situations. And quite frankly, they're self-regulating at a level that is quite more severe than what the federal law is. Is a comment that I had, and then one last question I had with for Senator Jensen. You had mentioned earlier that Minnesota 350 was not.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me for interrupting, but would you make a public announcement that lobbyists are not to approach members at the table?
Thank you. If anyone would like to speak to a member, just please get the attention of our pages and pass a note. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jensen, earlier you had testified that Minnesota 350 wasn't involved in your drafting committee in regards to this legislation. So far we've heard from some pipeline companies, some railroad companies, the conductors and the engineers. Were any of those groups involved on your drafting committee, or would you be willing to share with us who was on your drafting committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I wasn't on the drafting committee.
So, Senator Peterson, I can respond to that. There was an initial idea for some legislation that Minnesota 350 had proposed. That work was left to the side. These bills were drafted pretty much in conversation with the governor's office and staff, the agency, MnDOT, PCA, and DOT, in conjunction with House Counsel, some conversations with myself and Senator Hornstein. So these are not bills that were drafted by or even vetted by Minnesota 350.
So, well, Mr. Chair, my concern is that you have an industry right now that where the folks that operate these pipelines and railroads on a daily basis are very involved in training and safety and work to prevent these. But yet, you know, you just rattled off essentially four state agencies, and there was no input from, I mean, is that accurate that there was no input from the industry?
No, Senator, I mean, Representative Hornstein and I did have a fairly lengthy conversation with the industry, yes.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I've had conversations since taking on the bill with people from the industries as well.
Great, thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's concerning to me, though, because one of the things I found is some of the best legislation comes when all the stakeholders are involved in it and or can contribute to that or do a very good job of that. I mean, they know their businesses, and I think you can have competing parties, and sometimes that's the very best way is to have that and to have a look at it. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, we did do this in conjunction with the industries.
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear you.
We did do this in conjunction and with the industries.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, that's what this process is for.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard, I know.
All right, Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In speaking with Ms. Brzozowski, we have a proposed amendment to put before the committee.
All right. Ms. Brzozowski.
Mr. Chair and Senators, this is drawn to the A1 amendment. After line 2.24, insert C. The assessments under this subdivision expire on July 1, 2019.
All right. Any questions to the amendment, Senator Osmick, and
Mr.
then I'll have
Chair,
Senator
this
Jensen
conforms
respond.
With the House version, the companion that exists. So
right.
This would actually be conforming with what our friends in the House are doing.
All right.
Without bringing up the name of the other body.
Senator Jensen. We're good? All right.
Sounds good.
Everyone understands the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no? Motion carries. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sandrum.
Mr. Chair, maybe a question to you. And you may have simply omitted this by virtue of not thinking about it, but the Department of Public Safety, who is in fact within law the Emergency Response Commission, who is in fact the agency within state government that works on emergency preparedness specifically for hazardous material emergencies across this state, were they any part of the planning process to this?
Department of Public Safety.
Department of Public Safety?
Yes,
okay.
Senator Sandra. All right. So anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify? All right, Senator Jensen, do you have a motion?
Yes. I move that Senate File 2796 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to finance.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
The bill says that it's going to be referred to judiciary. Is that accurate? Or was that changed with the amendment?
Oh, I guess
Mr.
Senator
Chair, it was
Peterson,
changed with
that
the
was
amendment.
Changed with the amendment, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yep. All right. On the motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed no?
No.
Motion. Sorry. Motion carries. All right. So, members, we have another couple of three bills, two large bills and one tiny little bill. The Senate DFL is caucusing right now, and so we're going to just simply recess until 6:30 and come back in room 107. So
107.
107 at 6:30, and we need to find out who's buying the pizza. We are in recess.
I won't make my grandson's birthday.